Hi, thanks for checking out Press Play and our podcast. And when you're done with this one, I have another one that you're going to love. I just know it. It's a podcast about design and architecture, cars, gadgets, all sorts of things that make up our built and beautiful world. It's hosted by someone who is an insider who knows everything about design and architecture, Frances Anderton, and the podcast is called DNA. It's on KCRW's iTunes page, so check it out.
I was right there, Mr. Gardner, okay. Every step of the way,
right,
I had pictures,
brother,
everything.
Come on in.
I was doing everything peacefully, but it's gotten to the point where
you gotta keep the peace.
It's wrong.
I know.
We all are hurt.
It's like, where are we headed for? What's the future for me? What's the future for me? You know what I'm saying? For my child, for my son, what is his future?
That's a protester in New York yesterday talking to the stepfather of Eric Garner. The grand jury refused to indict the white police officer who used a chokehold to subdue Garner, who later died. But Attorney General Eric Holder announced that there will be a federal civil rights investigation into the incident that led to Garner's death. The Justice Department has also launched a civil rights probe into the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Devlin Barrett covers the Justice Department for The Wall Street Journal, and he's here now. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, what does the government need to prove to be able to successfully prosecute a civil rights case against Darryl Wilson, that's the officer in Ferguson, or Daniel Pantaleo, the New York officer who put the chokehold on Eric Garner?
Well, the minimum thing they have to establish is that there was an intent to deprive someone of their civil rights. Oftentimes, people misunderstand the civil rights laws and think that you have to show racial animus, that there was a sort of racist intent behind the action. That's one piece of law. You don't really need that to bring a charge. But what you do need to show is that a reasonable officer faced with the same situation would not have used that amount of force, would not have perceived that threat that officer perceived, and therefore acted essentially beyond the scope of regular police work and used force that was not appropriate to the situation.
And I have heard that is going to be a tough case to prove in Ferguson, Missouri.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's right. I think both within and outside the Justice Department, the people who specialize in these kinds of cases say that the Ferguson one will be particularly difficult to try to bring a charge on. And there's already some skepticism that, you know, before they finish, there's already plenty of skepticism that's going to happen.
And what about in the New York case?
Well, I think the New York case is actually a lot more interesting and has the potential for an actual charge for a couple of reasons. One, the video changes the dynamic. There is not a lot of argument to have about what specifically happened, as you saw in the Ferguson case. Ferguson had a lot of he said, right? This case doesn't really have much of that because you have the video. The other issue is this officer cannot make the argument, as Darren Wilson did in Ferguson, that he felt a threat to his life and followed police procedure. Neither of those claims really, I think, stand up to scrutiny in the New York City case. And so I think there is a larger window for bringing a federal charge in New York. And also there's history, too, in New York. There was a famous chokehold case brought in a chokehold death in 1994 against a New York City officer who was convicted.
What about the issue of double jeopardy, though? Is that a concern?
Well, it's not because, for one thing, he wasn't charged. If we're talking about New York, he wasn't charged. So double jeopardy really only applies to charging someone twice. For another, even in past cases, especially in New York, there have been state charges that have failed. The 94 case I mentioned, that officer went to trial in state court, was acquitted, and then was later charged in federal court and was convicted and served time.
Let's talk about the U.S. attorney whose district covers Staten Island,
right?
Loretta Lynch. She's been appointed by Eric Holder to run the civil rights investigation there. And she happens to be the president's nominee to take over for Holder. So this is going to be a case where a lot of people are paying a lot of attention to what she does.
Right. And basically what it means is that her nomination just got a bit more complicated, because almost no matter what job she has, she's going to be the one who decides whether the officer in the Garner case should be charged. And what's challenging about that for her in terms of the nomination is that the Fraternal Order of Police, the largest union in the country, the largest public service union in the country, hasn't decided whether or not to endorse her. They're looking at this very issue, this very case, as part of their decision making on her. And so I think it does make her nomination process a little more complicated. I don't imagine that it ultimately changes the outcome, but I think it could make it more complicated. I think it will make it more complicated.
And she prosecuted police officers in the Abner Louima case back in 1999.
That's right. As it happens, I covered that trial. She's a very able prosecutor, and she knows these issues very, very well.
And she has told stories about her own experiences with racial stereotyping. She said that in school she had to retake a standardized test because she did so well on it. So how is she going to bring her own personal experience to this, if she is at all?
Well, I think what Loretta Lynch brings to these discussions is, one, a very extensive legal background. She knows the law on these issues inside and out very well. Two, I think she brings a personal touch and a sort of a gravitas to this because of her resume. But I also think, you know, my dealings with her, she is a very calm, basically unflappable person. She does not get run too hot or too cold. And I think what you'll see is an effort on her part to be very deliberate and careful. But also, you know, she does worry about the relationship between police and minority communities, and that relationship is front and center right now.
Yeah. Well, how many of these civil rights investigations are brought because a case has gotten so much media attention?
In terms of criminal charges against individuals, not very many. I mean, that they are a rare breed within the Justice Department. They do not do them often. The investigations happen fairly often, but an actual filing of federal civil rights charges against a police officer is a fairly rare thing. Having said that, you know, this is sort of what this law was designed to try and address. But most people who specialize in these types of cases say they are always hard. It is always difficult to bring a federal case, and you know that's why they're rare.
Right. I mean, it's been 2 years since George Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin in Florida, and that investigation is still ongoing.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I think that investigation was never really headed anywhere meaningful. I think they wanted to show that they cared and that they were interested and that they would try to look at it from the federal point of view to see if there was charges brought. I think that the fact that investigation remains open, I think, frankly, says more about the unwillingness to tear the Band-Aid, so to speak, than any of the facts of the case.
Well, Devlin, thank you very much.
Sure, thank you.
That's Devlin Barrett. He covers the Justice Department for the Wall Street Journal. Well, Eric Garner's death came from a tactic that has officially been banned by the New York City Police Department for more than two decades, and that is the chokehold. Here in Los Angeles, chokeholds have an especially fraught history. The LAPD banned them in the early 1980s after police killed more than a dozen African Americans with chokeholds. Connie Rice is here now. She's a civil rights activist and lawyer and co-director of the Advancement Project. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, thank you. Now, aside from being controversial because of the physical harm the chokehold can do, has it always been seen as a racially charged tactic?
I don't know if I can answer always. I imagine the first time it was used in a black community, it immediately became infused with a normal resistance to police use of force. And police use of force in the black community is always racially charged.
And so it's been banned in Los Angeles for many decades now. Do you know if it's still being used as it is in New York?
Well, let me put it this way. I wouldn't be surprised to find out that it was used. You can outlaw all kinds of things. It doesn't mean the cops are going to follow the edicts. And I'm not sure. I haven't heard of any cases, but I'm not going to say that it isn't used in L.A.
Have there been complaints lodged against the police department in recent years?
Not that I'm aware of.
Now, tell us about the case that finally led to the ban here in Los Angeles. That's the death of James Thomas Mincy and why that touched such a nerve.
Oh, gosh, you're going back so many years. Well, you know, we had had in L.A. something like 17 killings with the chokehold in less than 10 years. And at the time, you had an LAPD that was openly brutal and gratuitously racist. It was a very ugly force in the black community. And so any kind of high-profile use of force immediately gained, like a wildfire, the kind of traction of a wildfire in the black community. And so this had just been too many. I really think it was just a matter of too many killings with this technique. And then you had the outrageous statement of the police chief explaining why so many black people died. When Chief Gates, you'll remember when he was asked, well, Chief, how come so many blacks die from the chokehold? He said, well, they're, you know, if they had normal necks, black people have peculiar necks, and so they don't react to the chokehold like normal people. And that really rubbed the black community the wrong way, as you can imagine. So I think all of that built to a crescendo, Madeline. And I think that crescendo meant that you had to take it off the table.
And how? What about his comments and then the issue of chokeholds? Do you think that they fueled, the riots that eventually exploded in 1990?
It was there. It was definitely there. You can see it in some of the articles that come along with describing the buildup, the kindling. It was part of the kindling, yeah. It was on the pyre as part of the kindling, and it helped to light the fire. It surely did.
Now, Bill Bratton, he was a police chief here in L.A. He was police chief in New York. He's back as police chief in New York, and he has to deal with this issue of the chokehold. What do you think he's going to do?
I think he's going to take it out of their wheelhouse. I think he's going to take it off the table for them so that they don't have to deal with it anymore, if I had to guess.
Although it is officially banned, and as you say, you can't really control what each and every police officer does on the street.
I should clarify. Yes, the chokehold, which is a very specific kind of hold, is banned. But they practice three other kinds of techniques that subdue a suspect. There's one where you concentrate on the arteries on the side of the neck and it'll make you pass out kind of quickly. And then there's another kind that I'm forgetting how it works. But technically they're not chokeholds because they're not suppressing the windpipe in the throat. And so, yeah, they're not allowed to use that particular angle of pressure on the throat, and they call that the chokehold. But then they've got these other techniques that focus on veins in the neck to knock a suspect out or somehow otherwise incapacitate them. And they look awfully like chokeholds. They really do look like chokeholds. So I'm not quite sure that the cops are making that big of a distinction, to tell you the truth. I would outlaw all of those holds.
And what about here in Los Angeles? Are all of those holds outlawed?
I think so, but I don't want to say with absolute certainty, because I'd have to ask some of the guys who see the most use of force in the field whether other similar holds are used. I don't think in L.A. they use anything close to the chokehold, but I might be wrong because cops change their techniques every 6 months. So I don't want to say, with certainty that it isn't. But my understanding is that there are no chokeholds of any kind used.
How do you think Los Angeles stacks up now to other police departments, maybe New York, in terms of community policing and the use of excessive force?
We're way ahead.
And, yeah. And is that because of the Rodney King riots?
Well, it's because of what we did in the wake of the Rodney King riots. And it's because, mainly because of the aftermath of the consent decrees that we went through.
Mm-hmm.
And it was after the Rampart scandal that LAPD finally hit bottom and was forced to pay attention to what we had all been saying. Finally, after the gangster cop scandal, the Rampart scandal, where you had cops planting evidence on people and dealing drugs, finally LAPD lost its grip on the intellectual elite of the city. And they washed their hands of LAPD, called the Justice Department, had a consent decree slapped on LAPD, and just washed their hands of the department because they were so disgusted by the gangster cops' antics. And once that happened, Madeline, we could finally force the department to heal. We could finally force the department to hit bottom. And when they hit bottom and they admitted they had a problem, they could finally start to recover, and they did.
Connie, thank you. It's great to talk to you.
It's great to be with you.
Connie Rice, civil rights activist and lawyer and co-director of the Advancement Project in Los Angeles. Coming up on the program, are we witnessing a new civil rights movement? Some observers say the protests against the police and the justice system represent a turning point. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Eric Garner's final words echoed through the streets in New York last night. Hundreds of people in cities across the country are protesting the Staten Island grand jury decision not to indict the police officer who killed Garner. Taken together with another grand jury decision, the one in Ferguson, and the police shooting of 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland, well, frustration and anger in the Black community is running high. But what happens to that anger? Where does it go? What happens next? Joining us now is Jody David Armour. He's a professor of law at USC, and he studies the intersection of race and law. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
And Joe Hicks, vice president of Community Advocates, a nonprofit that aims to better race relations in Los Angeles. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline.
All right, Jody, let's begin with you. These three cases, Eric Garner, Mike Brown, Tamir Rice, this cluster of cases, many people feel justice was not served. And we've seen lots of protests lately and people speaking out in the media and online. So what do you think? Do you think that these could be the first steps in a new civil rights movement?
Yeah, I think we're at an important historical inflection point. What we're seeing is interactions between the police department and especially Black males, especially poor Black males. And over a 30-year period, we've had a mass incarceration problem develop, and this is one of its faces. And so now people are starting to wonder, starting to reconsider whether this war on drugs that we have is worth the price we're paying in young Black lives, young Black male lives. You know, here in California, Proposition 47, that was the voters who, a generation and a half ago, Californians led the way in more punitive approaches to processing young Black males who are poor and caught up in the criminal justice system or interacting with law enforcement. Well, California took the lead just last month in rolling back that punitive approach and saying, let's create fewer opportunities for hostile interactions between police and Black males and poor males generally. So I think there is a hopeful sign in these troubled times.
And Joe, what do you think? Do you think that this is a point where things are going to start to change on a widespread level?
Well, it depends on what you mean by change. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of views about change, including Obama and hope and change. And so change gets thrown around a lot. I disagree with Jody. I do not think that this is beginning the new civil rights movement at all. For years, we've seen civil rights groups, NAACP, Urban League, SCLC, that's literally on the ropes, hanging on by its fingernails down in Atlanta, the organization founded by Dr. King. They can't really find an agenda to breathe life into, quote-unquote, a civil rights agenda. So along come these cases strung together all of which are separate and different and distinct cases. The only thing linking them, of course, is the skin color of the victims, as in Trayvon Martin, as in Sean Bell, as in Mr. Garner now. So these are all, you had people marching in the street with their fists in the air, more disturbingly, this hands-up kind of mythology. I don't think this is a civil rights movement. I think it is young people huffing the fumes of a bygone era where you had black folks and their allies in the streets around real, real issues that were affecting the daily lives of black people. Now, I agree with Jody around the incarceration issues. I think the so-called war on drugs has been just an abysmal failure at all sorts of levels, and the prisons and jails are full of largely young black men caught up in this whole drug war nonsense. That needs to be changed. So it's not as if there aren't reforms we need to examine to eliminate that. I think, cops zeroing in on this poor guy, Garner, in New York, because he was selling Lucy's, loose cigarettes, is a travesty. There should not have ever been that encounter with him that wound up with him being dead for selling loose cigarettes.
But what about this idea that these protests, I mean, these cases, as you say, are different, and you said they're just linked by one thing, that the color of the skin of the victim in these cases. But what about the idea that they've sparked this idea that there is unequal justice in the United States? There is a protest chant happening in the wake of these incidents, Black Lives Matter, basically saying that it doesn't seem in this country that Black lives matter as much as white lives.
That's just really insulting that mantra is going up all around the country that Black lives matter. Of course Black lives matter. Where is the lobby claiming that Black lives don't matter except for a few pathetic Klan members hanging on at the edges of society under rocks somewhere? So, this notion that you've got police out hunting down, let's make it white cops, even though we know many cities in this country, unlike Ferguson, have very diverse police forces. So the idea that white cops get up in the morning, or any cops get up in the morning, going out looking for young black men to victimize, that's an insult to people in uniform. That doesn't happen, yet this notion is widely spread and believed. We see it on the signs. We hear it in the chants of protesters. And again, that's part of a kind of a victimization thing. I think that all too many young black folks in this country get from mother's milk almost. Now, I've been one for several years arguing for a new black narrative that more accurately reflects who black people are in America contemporarily, that don't rely on this old, Jim Crow slavery kind of mantra to explain who black people are in America today. By the way, the stats, nobody's stats in America, FBI, any of the agencies chronicling crime, will say that there is, that it's open, quote, open season on young black men. We've created yet another mythology.
Okay, Jody, I want you to take on some of the points that Joe raised and talk a little bit about what you see in terms of the anger. Is it misplaced in the streets now, in the
oh,
in
not,
protests?
Oh, not at all. And Joe is stuffing a straw man just to knock him down when he says that black folks are saying cops get up in the morning saying, let me see what racist acts I can commit against black people. Nobody's saying that who I know who's thoughtful about these issues. What we're saying is there is a systemic problem. A pattern has emerged. We see a certain group, members of that group, grossly disproportionately suffering the burden of heavy-handed policing or of police violence. Black men are three times as likely to die in police custody than white men, okay? That's after they've been arrested, post-arrest. So there are empirical facts out here that support this belief that blacks, especially young black males, are bearing the brunt of America's law enforcement agenda and practices, and they could be bearing that brunt not because you have officers who are willfully going out to do racist acts, but because of implicit bias. We're learning a lot about the cognitive unconscious and how you can have racism without racist, for example. And this may be an example of that. Maybe we should approach this as a public health problem where we're trying to solve the problem of social stereotypes generally rather than trying to identify particular wrongdoers like bad cops or people who are maliciously out to do wrong. They may be unconscious victims of their own mental habits, as we all are. So there are many more, there are much more nuanced arguments out here than that straw man argument that Joe just threw out. And I can tell you, as a law professor, black man, I've been profiled in the last year a couple times in an egregious way. J.W. Marriott, they were getting ready to throw me out of the lobby because they thought I was a transient. So this is a black tax issue. Black folks recognize that they're suffering the brunt of these stereotypes, and they are rising up, and they're saying that we are tired of it. We've been, you know, suffering it too long, you know, in silence, and it's time to spread some of those blues around.
And I guess the question then is, what happens next? What does one do with all this anger and all this outrage?
Well, first and foremost, you do things like make sure that people you're hiring on the police force don't have the problem that the officer who shot 12-year-old Tamir Rice had. He was cut loose of the Independence Police Department he was in as unstable, and he found a job right next door in the Cleveland Police Department and wound up, you know, in this very violent and tragic confrontation with the 12-year-old Tamir. So you make sure that you do what you can on the personnel end, on the training end, et cetera. You try to do things to reduce the disproportionate involvement of blacks in crime that gives rise to the presence of law enforcement in black communities. We have to acknowledge that. I think Joe and I will be on the same page on that. We got to be truthful about realities, but also truthful about the sources of those realities and social economic inequality and that sort of thing, and focus our police resources on combating real crimes of force and violence.
So less broken windows. And Joe, what do you think? We'll give you the last word.
Well, Jody rightly calls me out on the straw man theory. So let me put some teeth into what I'm saying. The reason why there's so many encounters with the police and black men is that a lot of crime goes down in urban communities. In 2013, blacks committed 5,375 murders. Whites committed 4,396 murders. Now, as we know, black people only 13% of the population. So clearly, you know, if the NAACP was serious, if there's a need for a civil rights movement, one of the things is, are people inside of black communities getting serious about dealing with the real issues of education and, yes, even, you know, criminal justice reforms needed to take place, and dealing with rates of violence and homicide that is still an endemic part of black life in all too many urban cities.
All right, I think we'll have to leave it there. I want to thank you both very much for joining me. Joe Hicks, Vice President of Community Advocates. It's a nonprofit that aims for better race relations in Los Angeles. And Jody David Armour, law professor at USC, where he studies the intersection of race and law. Thank you both very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And what is your reaction to the protests against the grand jury decisions in New York and Ferguson? A needed movement or misdirected anger? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, switching gears, we'll meet Cameron Esposito and her partner, Rhea Butler. They're both comedians who spend a big part of their routines explaining the basics of their sexual orientation to straight people in a funny way. That's after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand, and this is comedian Cameron Esposito.
I didn't know I was gay, honestly. I didn't know I was gay until I was 20. Because I knew no gay people. I didn't know gay was a thing you could be. For me, where I grew up, I honestly think it would have been as difficult for me to realize I was a lesbian as it would have been for me to realize I was a leprechaun. Like, gays and leprechauns, I thought they were mythical creatures for parades!
Cameron Esposito grew up in the Midwest, and she spends a big chunk of her new album explaining the basics of her sexual orientation to straight people, especially to straight men who don't seem to get the whole lesbian thing. Esposito is making quite a name for herself, first as a rising star in LA's comedy scene and now across the country with her new album and her late show appearances. She's here now in the studio. Hello.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Well, I'm fine,
Didn't
thanks.
I listen to you on KCRW, the radio station that we're currently on?
Yeah.
So it's nice to see your face.
Well,
it's I know
nice
your
to
voice.
See your face, too.
Yeah.
Well, sitting next to you is your fiancé, Rhea
That's
Butcher.
Right. Hello.
Hello. Also a comedian.
Yes. Hilarious stand-up comic.
Oh, thank you.
Do you do a routine together, ever? Or are you solo?
We mostly perform separately, but we have a show here in Los Angeles at the UCB Theater, the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, and every Tuesday night we have a show called Put Your Hands Together, and we co-host it as a duo. So we're on stage together, and we tell hilarious stories as a duo, and we finish each other's...
Sandwiches!
Did you meet in the comedy world?
We did, actually. Yeah, I met Cameron basically the first time I did stand-up. She started an open mic at a bar called Cole's in Chicago that was in my neighborhood. And I went a bunch of times and watched her host it. And then she was very, like, encouraging and told me to try it. And then I finally did. And she saw me do stand-up for the first time.
Because stand-up kind of runs in classes. You know, the people you start with, it's you kind of advance at the same rate sort of together. So I was probably, like, a senior or junior at the time, even though we're, like, the same age. And Rhea was this emerging freshman voice. I got to see Rhea's first stand-up performance ever, which is such an amazing gift.
Was it funny?
She was so funny right away. Like, she was,
Do you have to say that? Because...
No, see, that's why we can date, because we didn't date until we were friends for like a year and a half, because I already knew she would be funny. There would be no worse punishment for a comic than falling in love with a terrible comic. That would be the worst.
And so, yeah.
She was already vetted. I already knew she was great. And then
I passed the test.
I think you think I'm funny.
Yes, you're hilarious. You're my favorite comic.
Oh, you're my favorite comic.
Oh my God, stop.
Sorry.
Do you tell each other jokes?
No, we like mostly are serious. I'm not even kidding.
Yeah.
The thing about comics is you have to be such a serious person to be into comedy. How serious
really?
Do you have to be what? To be really serious about joking around?
Is that a trick question or a
no,
joke?
No, it's so true. Oh. Like, we're just, I mean, we're stressing about like word choice in giggles. Like, these are ridiculous things to be worried about.
Do you ever steal each other's jokes?
It's happened a couple times. But by accident, because I've seen her tell her set countless times. And sometimes I will accidentally start speaking like her. Like, I don't necessarily take her jokes, but I'll start talking like her or holding my body the same way. And I think you've done
it. You have
to
really worry
too.
About that. Yeah, I've definitely slipped an
it's
accidental.
Like, have you ever seen the movie All About Eve?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm Betty Davis.
No, all right, I'll be George Saunders. It's all right.
I think it is really important to stay separated in people's minds, especially because people, it's very hilarious that anybody's like, well, they're both lesbians. They both wear flannels. They're exactly the same. Like, our material is totally different. Our backgrounds are totally different. We couldn't be from more different backgrounds. And
how are they different?
I'm from the suburbs in Chicago.
I'm from like a very Rust Belt town in Ohio. Divorced parents.
My parents have been together for 40 years. Bri is an only child.
You have two sisters.
Yeah.
So a lot different.
Very different.
A lot of your comedy is, can I say, lesbian comedy?
I mean,
is that?
Well, let's talk about what you mean by that, because I'm curious.
You talk a lot. You explain, as I said in the intro, what it is to be a lesbian.
You
talk about your haircut.
See, I would debate you on whether or not it's lesbian comedy.
Well, there was a question. Is that? Yeah. Is there a thing called lesbian comedy? I don't know.
No, I'm just a human person, and I think all of the best stand-up that you know, everybody's favorite stand-ups, they are talking about their lives in a really personal way. That's what is popular right now. The idea of like a one observational, like, hey, what's the deal with, you know, airplane food, that old trope, that's not...
No one's doing that.
The thing.
Yeah.
The thing is to talk about your life. And so my life is that I happen to be gay. So I use that viewpoint. I use that lens. I don't think about it like lesbian comedy. I just think about it as being truthful. Because how else would I approach the world?
But there is something novel when you go up on stage and just start talking about it, right? I mean, it's not every comedian, lesbian or not, who gets up on stage and talks about that.
That's true. That's a really great point. I do think that... So I had a terrible time coming out. I'm from a really conservative Catholic family, and I went to Catholic school my entire life, and I didn't know I was gay until I was 20, like I said in the clip, and then coming out, I was at a conservative Catholic college where, at the time, you could have been kicked out of school for being gay. There was no sexual orientation in the non-discrimination policy. And this wasn't like a hidden secret. Students asked them to put sexual orientation in there, and the university refused. So this did not happen to anybody I knew, but also nobody I knew was out on campus because you could have been kicked out of school for being gay. And that was my experience. When I came out to my folks, they were really worried that I was ruining my life. They were really sad for me. We just didn't know any gay people. We didn't know that you can have a really wonderful and happy life. We just didn't know what it would look like. So it was really tough with them for a long time. They're huge supporters of me, my career, and my comedy, and also my personal life. They love Rhea, but it was a huge and long journey to get there. And so I think that right now it's really important to be on stage and talking about my life because we are in this moment of national transition, but so many people are left behind and so many people still need to hear this. There are so many kids out there that need to hear that they're going to be okay.
Yeah. And Rhea, do you have the same experience? Do you feel like you need to do the same thing on stage?
Oh, for sure. I mean, my experience was different coming out. It took me a long time just because of internal factors that I was raised in a Catholic environment. I wasn't necessarily Catholic, but I had divorced parents. So I had sort of strained familial relationships. Everything was sort of separated. And I basically like didn't want to rock the boat by coming out. So I was like, well, I'll just not do that. And actually doing stand-up really helped me realize that honesty is a really powerful thing, not just for yourself, but for other people. And other people seeing somebody that looks like me and talks like me and has experiences like me, it would be really helpful because I saw people when I was a kid, like Ellen DeGeneres, and I was like, oh my God, that's me. That's who I am. And so I wanted to give like as much of that back as I possibly could. And for me, it's been really important specifically to call myself a lesbian because a lot of people don't use that word because they think it sounds weird or gross or something like that. It's
offensive.
Yeah. Some people think it's offensive. Some people think it's weird. Like they'd rather call themselves gay. And I think while it's a small thing, I think it's important. You know, that's who I am. And I'm proud of that. And I wouldn't want anybody to think what I am is like gross or offensive.
I'm speaking with Cameron Esposito and Rhea Butcher. They are LA-based comedians, and they co-host a podcast called Wham Bam Pow. Cameron's new record is called Same Sex Symbol. Let's take a listen.
I was a little gay kid with crossed eyes. I had crossed eyes when I was a kid. I wore an eye patch for 8 years of my childhood. 8 years! So there's probably no reason I'm funny at all. There's not anything I had to distract anybody from. It's fine. When you're a little kid and you have an eye patch, they don't give you like a cool black with a thing around the head, like a Johnny Depp, sort of like a conquistador, like a hello. You're like, you don't get like a cool, like a walking the plank, like a pirate patch. When you're a little kid and you have an eye patch, you have to wear a flesh-toned Band-Aid material disposable eye patch. When you put it on your face, it just looks like more skin. It looks like Sloth from the Goonies, but a little girl.
Cameron Esposito. I mean, that's funny, but really sad. I don't know.
It took me so long to figure out how to tell that bit. Yeah. Because for many years, I would try to talk about that on stage and people would just be like, this is terrible.
It's so sad.
Yeah, I get into like some detail about the stickers that they provided with the eye patch because they were like trying to make little kids feel better, but they put stickers in there and they were these little circles and they would have a little design on them that would be like a farm scene. Just take up an eye patch and make it less cool. Just a brown owl with a taupe hat on. And then you're supposed to put that on an eye patch and just go to school. That's what I did.
Okay, so you're describing this kind of difficult, geeky childhood that you had.
Absolutely.
Here you are. I don't know how many years later, but...
I'm 33. It's my Jesus year.
Oh, well, happy Jesus year.
Thank you.
And it seems like this is your year professionally.
Oh, I hope so. That's very nice of you to say. Things seem
what
to be coming together.
What do you think? I mean, it seems like you're blowing up. You're everywhere.
Yeah, there's definitely been a huge difference in the last year. That's true.
And what do you think about your comedy for an LA audience versus a Midwest audience? Do either one of you feel like you need to adjust it and change it? Because it's a totally different audience.
I used to think that I needed to. I have this one very specific joke that I say. I'm from Ohio, which I like to call the thinking man's Indiana, which I didn't think anybody in Los Angeles would care about because, like, who cares? We're not from the Midwest. But they love it. And then when I told that joke and it got a good reaction, I was like, oh, I don't think I need to change my jokes too much. You know, usually it's just like the energy of the room is different and you have to work harder in Los Angeles rooms as opposed to Midwestern rooms just because the exposure to comedy is a lot lower. But that's also equally good training as compared to Chicago. Like, you have to work it to get people in Los Angeles to lean forward and uncross their arms, you know?
Yeah, that's, I love that thought. I think you're totally right. You have to keep your material consistent. You can't adjust your material, but your delivery, you have to be able to read the room. And I think that's a sign of a good comic is when you can mix those two things together, adjust your delivery, adjust your timing, and, you know, talk to people in the audience, but also that you stay strong in your material.
As I mentioned, you two host a weekly comedy show at UCB, and here's a clip of you performing there, Rhea, talking about your decision to quit drinking for a while. So let's take a listen.
About a year ago, I decided to give up drinking, just because I've been doing it for a long time. The first time I ever drank, I was about 12 years old, and I chugged two Colt 45-40s in direct succession, both of which I smashed on a brick wall. They don't just give you this jean jacket. You have to earn it. So I decided to take a break from drugs and alcohol for a little while. And it is true what they say. Like, I feel like I can see better, smell better, hear better, like things taste better, but no sense is more heightened than my sense of superiority.
Is that true? Are you still not drinking? Feeling superior
still
to everyone else?
Still feeling super superior.
Super smug.
Super smug. So much better than everybody else.
And I guess you haven't stopped.
Well, I'm not a huge drinker. I just never have been. I know that's disproving everything you know about stand-up comics.
I know.
But yeah, I'm exhausted. Like, I travel every weekend pretty much. And we get up at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning and get to work. Like, this is not stand up. The life of a stand up comic is not staying up till 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, chilling in the back of the room with like a tumbler of whiskey. It is like get in, get your set in, get home so you can sleep as much as possible so you can get up in the morning and rebook more shows or get on a plane or go film something.
We're definitely the business women of comedy. Cameron carries a briefcase everywhere we go. And if it was the 80s, she would have the best shoulder pads in the room.
Absolutely.
It's the biggest.
Well, you've got kind of the mullet thing happening, but on the side. So it's the business on the side and party on the
That's
side,
right.
too.
You're naming it right. This is a side mullet. That's exactly what I call it.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming in.
It was a total pleasure to talk. Yeah, thank you.
Cameron Esposito, Rhea Butcher, and together they host the podcast Wham Bam Pow. And Cameron's new debut album is called Same Sex Symbol. They host the show Put Your Hands Together every Tuesday at the Upright Citizens Brigade. And hosting a show every day at 1 o'clock is Warren Olney, who's here now.
Every day at 1 o'clock, I have to get up in the morning and come in and do it.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're going to have a very, you know, interesting, challenging show today about the justice system and all of the problems that we have seen with it of late and what might be done about them. Particularly now, there's focus on Cleveland, where there was another terrible shooting, a 12-year-old boy killed by a policeman as he was getting out of his car. It happened in 2 seconds after they arrived on the scene. The kid had a gun, which turned out to be a toy, and he was 12 years old.
Okay, that's coming up at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank you. And coming up on this show, some lighter fare, Bond is back. We'll tell you about the new movie announced today, next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. That, of course, is the theme to Dr. No, the first James Bond film in 1962. It seems that the Bond franchise is as unstoppable as 007 himself. The 24th Bond film was announced this morning. It's called Spectre, and it will again star Daniel Craig as Bond. Sam Mendes, who directed the last 007 film, Skyfall, is back again to direct. Scott Mance is an unabashed fan of Bond, his cars, gadgets, and girls. He's a film critic at Access Hollywood and a regular on our Friday film segments here at Press Play. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. Okay, so this is called Spectre, and for the Bond fan, that will sound familiar because that's the organization headed by Ernst Stavro Blofeld.
Well, this is very exciting because having the Spectre back in a Bond movie will be like saying, oh, the Darth Vader is going to be back in the next Star Wars movie, or that the Klingons are going to be in the next Star Trek movie. Spectre is synonymous with Bond because it's his arch enemy, really.
Spectre is the organization, though, right?
Spectre is the organization, and it stands for Special Executive for Counterintelligence, Terrorism, Revenge, and Extortion. So it's a pretty ominous acronym.
So who's going to be Blofeld? Are they going to bring back Blofeld?
Well, we don't know for sure if the return of Spectre means the return of Blofeld. Now, what we do know is that Christoph Waltz, two-time Oscar winner, will be in the film, and he's not officially playing a character named Blofeld, but I don't think that the Bond producers, who are very, very secretive, of course, Barbara Broccoli is the daughter of Albert Cubby Broccoli, who had been producing all the James Bond movies going back to the early 60s. I don't think they're going to just lay everything out on the table now. They have to keep the fans and the Bond lovers a little hungry for some information, and I don't think they would blow it so early by revealing a surprise that could happen in the new Bond movie.
Okay, talk about the new Bond films, because they did get a reboot, and after Albert Broccoli died in 1996, because he had a firm grip over the franchise. How did the series change after he died?
Well, even after he died, the heirs to the empire, so to speak, had just affirmed as a grip. They are even more secretive, if anything. But what happened was, you know, the Timothy Dalton movies weren't that great. And while the Pierce Brosnan movies, he did four of them, they did very well. They were all about spectacle. And then Austin Powers came around and spoofed the whole series into the ground. They needed to reinvent Bond to make him relevant, to make him a cool character again. And when the producers, Barbara Broccoli, went and saw 2005's Batman Begins, directed by Christopher Nolan, and she saw the way that character was reinvented, he was darker, he was grittier, and he was cooler, she said, that is what we need to do with James Bond, and the result was 2006's Casino Royale.
Well, the Bond films, they've been around for so long. Are they the most successful movie franchise?
Well, if you adjust them for inflation, you know, the 23 official James Bond movies have grossed more than $5 billion worldwide. And the only other series that really sort of gives Bond a run for its money is the Harry Potter series. You had 8 films that also made over $5 billion, but they also came out over the last 13 years when ticket prices were much, much higher and movies opened in more than 3,000 theaters domestically.
Harry Potter, those films are based on the books, and, you know, there's a finite number of the books. But the Bond films, they can seemingly go on forever because they're not really based on the books anymore.
When people think about Harry Potter, most likely they've read the books. They think of the books, and then they think of the movies. With James Bond, they think of the movies first, and then maybe they'll think of the books. But it's been a very, very long time since a James Bond movie was based on any particular book. So that's why, if anything, that series can keep reinventing itself. They're able to reset everything, wipe the slate clean, start all over again, make it relevant for a new audience. And again, this is what a character, what a film series needs to do. It needs to grow and evolve. Sometimes the only way to do that is to reboot everything, start from scratch.
Which is your favorite?
Oh, you know, my favorite, I got to tell you, was Skyfall.
Really?
Skyfall was great. It was all about the character. You didn't have the cheesy one-liners. It wasn't all about the gadgets. The character was stripped down to its basics. Skyfall wasn't just a great James Bond movie. It was a great movie, period. And the fact that it made over $1 billion, making it by far the most successful Bond movie ever made, Obviously, director Sam Mendes, Oscar winner for 1999's American Beauty, he knew exactly what he was doing, which is why he's back for Spectre. And boy, the film could not be in better hands.
You know, you mentioned all these things that you don't like, the cheesy one-liners and the gadgets. That's what I like about the old Bond movies.
Well, from a nostalgia standpoint, I love going back and watching, especially the Roger Moore films. Those were the Bond movies that I grew up with back in the 70s. He was my first Bond. And then when I went back further than that and saw, you know, From Russia with Love and Goldfinger and Thunderball, I went, oh, okay, that's what James Bond should be. So, you know, I grew up with those cheesy movies and the gadgets and, you know, Moonraker when it came out in 79, I thought that was a great movie. Of course, in hindsight, I realized it's actually one of the worst Bond movies ever made. And a lot of people still have a nostalgia for the old stuff, but that's what Blu-rays and DVDs and downloads and renting is for.
Well, thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
That's Scott Mance. He's a regular on our Friday film segments and a film critic at Access Hollywood. Spectre, the 24th movie in the James Bond franchise, is scheduled to open here in the United States on November 6th of next year. Almost a whole year we have to wait before we see that. Julie Myers.
Yeah, whatever.
So you can watch all the other Bond movies in between then.
I'm a Daniel Craig aficionado if I'm not a Bond aficionado, so I guess I'll be waiting in line with everybody else in November. Okay, so earlier in the show, before we talked about Bond, we talked about protests in New York and Ferguson, and we asked whether or not we were looking at a new civil rights movement, and we wanted to know what you all thought about those protests. Over on Facebook, Christine Marie says that it's hard to judge. She thinks the grand jury got it right in Ferguson and did not get it right in Staten Island, so she doesn't really know where to put all that. Jasmine called in. She says she doesn't think we've quite reached the movement level yet, but we could be close.
Now there's this reason, there's this place to speak out, because look at right now, we're having this discussion on the radio. So people are hearing this discussion now, and it's going to give them a reason to move to action versus having no platform to stand on with which to express their opinions. So I think these protests, while they might not be the full blown avalanche at the moment, but they have the potential to develop that momentum.
And Alicia Campos echoes that point on Facebook. After Mike Brown, after Eric Garner, something's gotta give.
Okay, keep the comments coming. Facebook, KCRW Press Play, Twitter, at KCRW Press Play, and you can leave a voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Julie Myers, thank you very
much.
Warren Olney up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.